Well, I'm very happy to be here with you this day. I've been in your church a few times over the years. I'm a part of Heritage Bible Church, and of course, we're sister churches. And so I've been here for various occasions, special events and so forth. But this is the first time I've been here for a regular service, I think. And it's kind of nice to look out and see a lot of folks I already know. And I know some of you probably had me for a class at Bob Jones at some point. And you probably, depending on what class, you may have even heard some of what I'm going to say this morning, but hopefully it will still be helpful and a blessing to you. I was very intrigued, honestly, intrigued and delighted when Pastor Brad contacted me and informed me what you do during December and the emphasis on Advent and how it connects with missions and reaching the lost locally as well as around the world. I've heard of a few churches that do something similar to that, but I've never been part of that. I've never seen that in action. And it really is, I think, a wonderful way to connect Christmas season. I've been sort of my whole life a little bit of a Grinch or a Scrooge. And partly because it really pains me on some level how little Christmas ends up having to do with the coming of Christ and the importance of that coming. And so maybe I overreact. I'm not anti-Christmas. I'm not anti-celebration. But I've never been super big on all of the commercialization. And it seems like we take something away from what Christmas is all about. So your emphasis here is a great joy to me. Well, as we look at the passage in Matthew 28 this morning, I anticipate that some of you will quite naturally say, oh boy, here we go, another message on the Great Commission. What more could possibly be said about the Great Commission? And that's a reasonable response. In fact, I was telling Brad the other day when we met, for many years of public ministry, my whole adult life ministry has in some way revolved around missions. And over the years, it's revolved around missions on a number of different levels and a number of different ways of participating. But when I first started speaking about missions in churches and so forth, I assiduously avoided all of the commission passages, because I felt like it was jaded. Like so much had already been said, and it couldn't be fresh, and it couldn't be connective, and so forth. When I actually started teaching missions, part of what I felt compelled to do was to really go back and struggle through the texts one by one, and make sure that I very much understood what was happening in the passages we think of as commission passages. And to my surprise, I found that most of what I had assumed, at least on some level, was either incorrect or misguided. And so now I take real delight in preaching from various commission passages, including this one we often think of as the Great Commission in Matthew chapter 28. In looking at the commission itself, which we typically think of as verses 19 and 20, oftentimes, the message becomes something about mission strategy or the technicalities of missions or the components of spreading the gospel, and that's all very legitimate. But what I want to focus on with you today, connecting this idea of Christmas joy and Christmas communication with the last words of Jesus in Matthew 28, I want to connect that with the entire book of Matthew in the sense that this book begins with Jesus, the incarnate king. He's born the king of the Jews. People come from afar to find the king of the Jews. Jesus is, throughout the book, revealing his authority, legitimizing his role as the king over Israel. And as you come to the end and you go through the experience of Christ's passion and his crucifixion, his suffering, and his unanticipated, at least by the people around him, resurrection, we find that Jesus is king not just of Israel, but Jesus is king of everything. And that leads to an understanding of what our responsibility, our relationship, our role is in announcing the king. But in this passage itself, I think we find the core motivation, the driving factor, what pushes people like Brian Kane to a place like Cambodia, what pushes people to some of the most difficult places on the planet, and among some of the most difficult people, people are vastly different than we are, and oftentimes hostile to Christianity, to the very notion of the gospel. What pushes people to go and to do that? And of course, we could talk about a number of things. We could talk about the tremendous need. We could talk about the fact that we have a command from God to go and do these things. We could talk about the fact that people are lost and the implications of lostness and damnation and eternal loss. But I think the real core, the central motivating factor is actually found right here in this text. And perhaps we miss it because we jump in at verse 18, maybe 19 and 20, and I think we have to back up just a little bit farther, which is why I asked that the entire passage be looked at, or at least the key parts of this passage be looked at in our reading this morning. You find that on the day of resurrection, no one was really expecting that. We read in the Luke account that there were some disciples sort of singing the blues and walking their path to the little village of Emmaus, and Jesus meets up with them, and he basically says, "Why are you guys so bummed out?" I don't know what translation that is, but I mean, that's basically what's going on, right? And they're like, "Well, don't you know what's been going on in Jerusalem?" And Jesus says, "What's been going on in Jerusalem? Well, we thought this Jesus of Nazareth was our Messiah, that he was going to be our king. He was going to establish a rule over Israel, and he was going to fix all of our problems and bring in utopia, and now he's dead." And some people say he's been resurrected, but wow, we don't know what to make of that. So Jesus goes through the entire Old Testament, gives them that review, right? Don't you hope there's going to be like instant replay in heaven? We get to heaven, you know, like that. Just think, I mean, I'm serious. Think about this. You know, I want to meet Zacchaeus. I want to see just how tall he really was, or not. And I'm not going to be in a hurry. It's like, "Hey, Zacchaeus, do you have time for lunch? It might take us 300 years. So what? You know, let's just talk. Let's just talk about everything." And I want to go back and I want to hear those words that Jesus impressed on those two sort of miserable, bummed out disciples on the road to Emmaus. And then Jesus reveals himself. It's actually me. And they recognize him, maybe even something about the way he broke the bread, something familiar, and then he's gone. And they run all the way back and they tell the story. We also know that on that resurrection day, the women at the tomb were not anticipating a resurrection. They're there looking for how they can further care for the body. And they meet first angels, and they meet someone they think is a gardener, and they find it's Jesus. And among the things that Jesus says to the women is, "Go tell my disciples to go before me and meet me in Galilee, and I will meet them there." So this passage in Matthew 28, this passage we know as the commission, takes place in Galilee. And that's significant in part because Jesus had appointed specifically a meeting place for his disciples, for his 11 disciples. Contrary to what you probably have heard, it's kind of striking to me how often I hear this. These are not Jesus' last words. They may be his last commandment, depending on how you take what takes place in Acts chapter 1. But when Jesus actually ascends to heaven, that's taking place in Acts 1 from the Mount of Olives, which is in Jerusalem. This passage that we're reading today takes place in Galilee. So there's a gap. We also know that Jesus had appeared before his disciples at least several times before they went back to Galilee. On the very day of his resurrection, after appearing to the disciples on the road to Emmaus, after they came back and told their news, Jesus himself appears. And Jesus reveals to them that he is risen from the dead. In fact, when Luke describes this in his second volume of the Jesus story in Acts, he says in verse 3 that Jesus presented himself alive after his suffering by many proofs, by many infallible proofs. He has demonstrated. So, for example, in John chapter 20, Jesus shows up and the disciples are afraid. They don't know what to make of this. It's kind of taking them off guard. And Jesus assures them that he's not a spirit. They think, you know, I'm seeing a ghost. I'm seeing something fantastic here, but it's not an actual physical person come back from the dead. And so Jesus tells them, I have flesh and bones. I heard this crazy sermon, one of the strangest sermons I've ever heard one time, about why didn't Jesus say flesh and blood? Because he had no blood. All the blood was shed. And he totally missed the point. And the message was downhill from there, believe me. Jesus says, I have no flesh. I have flesh and bones because you can feel flesh and bone. I mean, if you come up here and you grab a hold of me, you feel lots of flesh, actually. And bone, there's bone in there, too. But you can't feel blood. You assume there's blood, but you don't feel the blood. So he says to his disciples, I have flesh and bone. And then later, Thomas, who wasn't there, of course, you know this story. Thomas shows up and he says, yeah, okay. But I'm not going to believe till I can actually see. I want to put my fingers in the holes in his hands. So Jesus, being the ever gracious, kind, forbearing king that he is, he comes back and he says, hey, Thomas, what you doing? Why don't you come over here and put your fingers right here? And Thomas doesn't do it, right? Thomas is kind of blown away. Thomas probably falls flat on his face and says, oh, Jesus, you are my Lord. You are my God. Well, sometime after all that, so Jesus, in proving, he gives them the opportunity to touch him if they want. He eats in front of them, right? If it's a spirit, it's going to go right through onto the floor, I assume. He drinks in front of them. We learn that in a passage in Acts that he drank in front of them as well. And so he's proving by various means, I am the actual physical resurrected Jesus. And now they're in Galilee, and they're meeting with him at this appointed place. In verse 7, it tells us that they are meeting in the place of appointment, in the place where Jesus had told them, go quickly to his disciples, to tell them that he has risen from the dead. This is what the angels say. Behold, he is going before you to Galilee, and there you will see him. Then later, Jesus to the women in verse 10, Jesus says to them, do not be afraid, go tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and from there they will see me. So now, as we see the passage beginning to unfold in verse 16, we see that they're in Galilee at a mountain. We don't know what mountain this is. It could have been the Mount of Transfiguration. It could have been the mount where Jesus gave the sermon that we know as the Sermon on the Mount. It could have been the mount where he fed the 5,000. We don't know. But the disciples knew, and so they're there. And what is really, I think, very key to our understanding is that it says in verse 16, when the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them, when they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted. We probably have read that verse our whole life and sort of passed over it. But let's not pass over it, because it's critical to our understanding, to our thinking through what takes place in this passage, that we understand that there are 11 men who were keenly interested in the life and even more so in the resurrection of Jesus, to whom it had been proven various times and in various ways that he was in fact resurrected from the dead. And so, like Thomas, they're worshiping him. They see him, and they worship him. But not all of them. Some are doubting. And so you look at that, and you have to ask, naturally, what is it that they're doubting? Well, the assumption, the common response is they're doubting the resurrection. And I want to say to that, really? At this point, after seeing Jesus, after being invited to touch him, after watching him eat and drink in front of them, after these various proofs, they're doubting the resurrection? I don't think so. So what are they doubting? Well, the doubt here in this verse is actually juxtaposed to the worship. So you have 11 men. It's important that we recognize from the text, these are the 11 disciples. Obviously, Judas isn't there. Judas is now dead. So there are 11 of those chosen followers, those apostles of Jesus. And as Jesus approaches them, apparently some of them, they respond by worshiping. And some of them respond by doubting. It's helpful to know that the word that's translated doubt there is a word that is only used two times in the entire Bible, in the entire New Testament. There are various ways to think about doubt in English or in other languages. Doubt can mean the absence of belief. Doubt can mean uncertainty. Doubt can express maybe fear. But the word that's used here is a word that is only used one other time in the New Testament. It's actually also used in the book of Matthew. Let me read to you the verse where this word is used. It says, "And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, 'Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?'" Do you remember that verse? Who's the subject in that verse? Who was it that Jesus reached out and grabbed? It was Peter. And why did Jesus have to reach out and grab him? Because he was going down, right? Jesus had appeared to them walking on water. I mean, Jesus had this way of just kind of freaking out his disciples, right? And surprising them. At every turn, he's surprising them. And so he had sent them across the Sea of Galilee. He said, "You go before, I'm going to stay here and pray." And it says in one of the Gospels, he actually could see them from his vantage point out on the sea, out on the water, and he knew they were in trouble. And so he goes to them. He's walking towards them. You know, why did Jesus walk towards them? Why didn't he just show up in a boat? I don't know. Why didn't he just pick up the boat, you know, supernaturally and have it land on shore? I don't know. But he chooses to walk there. He shows up walking. He shows them he has power over everything, over creation. And so the disciples, they're afraid. You know, what's going on? Why are you doing this? And how are you doing this? And Peter, we beat up on Peter because he does tend to be impulsive. He does tend to speak rather quickly, often what seems to us without thinking. But Peter says, "Lord, if it's you, let me come out there." I don't think for a moment that Peter was like, "Hey, this, you know, I've never bungee jumped. Let me try that. I've never walked on water. I'm going to try it. Here's my chance." I don't think that's what's going through Peter's mind. I think what's going through Peter's mind is, you know, here in the boat, we're in trouble. We're going down. Jesus is out there. Look at him. He's perfectly fine. Whatever else is happening, Jesus is safe and we're not. I'm going there. Right? Because when I'm with Jesus, it's always okay. So he says, "Lord, can I come out there?" And Jesus says, "Yeah, come up." So off Peter goes. I think Peter just wants to be with Jesus. Right? There's a great missions principle in that too, right? Like Jesus is going to Uzbekistan. I'm going to follow him to Uzbekistan. Martin Burnham, who was killed in the Philippines, unfortunately, after having been held for several years by Abu Sayyaf, the Islamic terrorist group there, his wife, Gracia, was rescued. Martin was killed in the rescue attempt. They found Martin's Bible, and he had written in the flyleaf of his Bible, "Jesus never asked me to be a missionary. Jesus never asked me to come to the Philippines. Jesus just asked me to follow him. And I did. I think there's a great power in that. There's something very rich in just saying, okay, Jesus, if you're wanting to do something there, I'm going with you, wherever that is. So that's Peter's heart. I mean, Peter's, he's simple, he's impulsive, but God bless him. He's out of the boat. He's there. And so, obviously, he's standing on water. The waves and the wind are still all about him, and he starts to go down. Of course he starts to go down, right? I would have been in the boat. At least Peter is out there on the water, and so he starts to go down. And I don't think Jesus rebukes him. I think Jesus looks at him with an enormous heart of compassion and says, oh, Peter, you still don't get it. You still don't know who I am. Why are you doubting me? Well, the word there that's used for doubt is a very descriptive word. In fact, it means literally to waver, to be unstable. In fact, outside of New Testament of our Bibles, in first century Greek, that word is often used to describe drunkenness. You've seen people that are drunk, and they're unstable, right? You feel for them because they look like they're about to fall down. Can you see Peter on the water? I mean, that's exactly what Peter must have looked like on the water. And he's going down and Jesus rescues him. And so now take that same thought, go back in your mind to Matthew 28. And some of the 11 disciples are worshiping Jesus and some are unstable. Well, what does that mean? Think about it. These are, every one of them, Jewish men. Very devout Jewish men. Very committed Jewish men. Have you noticed in the Old Testament when God shows up, there's not just a emotional or heartfelt response. There's often a physical response. You know, the prophet will fall flat on his face or fall on his knees. Or you see the psalmist raising holy hands, right? So Jewish worship was demonstrative. It was natural for a Jewish person to show their submission to deity, their commitment in this sense of worship to God by physically responding, by falling down, by maybe laying flat out. And I suspect that some of the 11, probably the first among them would have been Thomas. He's down on his knees, maybe flat on his face. Maybe Peter standing there like this. But you've got this variety, but some of them are wavering. And I really think Matthew's giving us this impression that some of them are like, I'm not sure. It's not that they're doubting that this is Jesus the Messiah. It's not that they're doubting that he's raised from the dead. It's not that they're doubting that he is the Son of God. It's that they're doubting that he deserves the same level of worship that they had given to Yahweh, to the Creator, to the covenant God of Israel throughout their whole lives. And now some of them are worshiping him the same way you worship the God of the Old Testament, the God of Israel. And some are just not quite sure. That's the image. That's the portrait. And that is precisely when Jesus says in verse 18, all authority is given unto me in heaven and in earth. So in other words, Jesus is responding to the doubt. Jesus doesn't just show up and say, oh, by the way, I want you to know, hey, if you haven't already thought about it, I have all authority everywhere. No. He's speaking directly into their context, into the moment. These guys that are not sure whether they should worship this way, Jesus tells them, look, let's make this very, very clear. I am the King of the Jews, but beyond that, I'm the king of everything. There's not a corner or a speck of this universe where I am not completely in charge. Jesus has all authority on heaven and on earth. And so he answers their doubt by telling them, not only may you worship me, you must worship me. And part of the message of the rest of the New Testament is that every living being at some point in time will bend their knee before Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the ultimate King of Glory. It will happen. But Jesus wants people to do that now, while they can, while they may, without being forced, without being pushed down by some angelic hand, without being pushed down by the weight of their guilt and the threat of eternal damnation. He wants them to bend their knee, to bow their heart, to give their submission to him as their Lord now. And so he tells the disciples, so go and tell. You go and make disciples. And so what Jesus is doing in this passage is he's looking at these men who know fully well who he is and who have just been re-informed or maybe clarified in their hearts and minds exactly what authority Jesus has. And Jesus says, now you go and you find others to follow me. You go and you spread this message. You go and you take all of this splendor and joy and enthusiasm and motivation for me. You take that and you spread that. You do what I've done with you. Reveal me. Show me to those around you. To those literally in all parts of the earth. Among all nations. Among all the peoples of the earth. And so these disciples understand very well what Jesus is saying. The psalmist wrote about the worship of the Lord. He said in Psalm 22:27, all the ends of the earth shall remember and turn to the Lord. All the families of the nations shall worship before you. In Psalm 66:4, all the earth shall worship you and sing praises to you. They shall sing praises to your name. In Psalm 97:1, the Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the multitude of isles be glad. So Jesus coming, Jesus' incarnation, the advent of Jesus into the earth, is ultimately for this purpose, that every person everywhere can worship him. And those who are best equipped to go and to make fellow worshipers are those who are completely engrossed themselves in the worship of the risen Jesus. Worship, I had this big discussion, I won't say the name, I had this big discussion once with sort of the archetypal fundamentalist. And this was somewhat recently. And it was about the issue of worship. Because I had said something in class like, you know, God dances a happy dance when people get saved. And somebody didn't like that, and it made its way back to somebody else. And then, yeah, that's how I get myself in trouble. But I do think God has a happy dance. I think the reason, I mean, this is an excursus. But I think that because every person on the planet, every culture, every people has a happy dance. I mean, some of them look kind of weird, you know, but they all have a happy dance. Why does every person on the planet have a happy dance? Because we're made in the image of God. And nobody is happier than God. Right? And so there's joy not among the angels, but in the presence of the angels when one sinner is converted. And I really think God gets really happy. And so when we enter into that kind of happiness, we begin to understand worship. And so my discussion with this friend was that worship is not simply properly packaging the right components in the right order with the right style and the right response and all of that. That's how animists think. That's how people in the jungle think, right? If I can just get everything just right. My deity will be happy with me for another day till I can come back and do it again tomorrow. And there's Christians sitting in pews all over America right now that think that way. They say, this is my Christian worship. No, it's not. You're worshiping God as if he's some kind of a pagan deity who needs to be placated for another day. But that's not the God we serve. The God we serve is full of joy and mercy and kindness. And he is looking for people to worship him in spirit and in truth. And real worship is when my heart is so full of him that with every fiber of my being, I want to do what he wants me to do. I want to be what he wants me to be. I want to sing and give him the adoration and the praise that he rightly deserves. And Jesus is saying to these men, I am that God. So worship me. And then take that satisfying, soul-filling, soul-redeeming joy of your worship and spread it all over the world. So we talk about, you know, what are the various components of the Great Commission? And there's one command, one like hortatory word there to make disciples. And the others are sort of ancillary. They all go together. How do you make disciples? Well, you got to go, because if you're not going, you're not making disciples. They're not exactly lining up at my door to come and be made disciples. And you've got to baptize, because baptism is a way of showing my commitment as a disciple. There's a lot we could say about baptism, and every church has its own particular perspective on that. I'm not going to try to get into that here. That's not the point. But at least on the surface in this passage, baptism, as had been true for people converting to Judaism, the proselytes from Gentile to Jewishness, those who were baptized by John the Baptist, and now these baptized by the disciples in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, they're showing, I am one of these. I belong. I am part of this. I am showing you my commitment to Jesus as my Lord. And in our society, that means probably very little, I'm afraid. But I've been in places where that means everything. I remember the first time I went to China meeting some girls, college-age girls, who were debating whether they were going to be baptized. This would have been, I don't know, almost 20 years ago, I think. And they were struggling because they knew the day that they were baptized, they would be probably ostracized by their parents. They would lose their identity card, which is like becoming a non-person. Your identity card in China is everything. They would probably not be able to continue in university, and they may never have a good job. And they were wrestling through this. And I talked with them a little bit, and I thought, what do I say? You know, you should be baptized because Jesus commands it. Okay, thank you very much. And I remember praying with them. And then I saw them. We went to some other ministry, came back, and I saw these girls about a month later, I think it was several weeks later. And I asked them, so what have you decided? And they said, oh, we've all been baptized. That's joy. I remember meeting a guy once in West Africa. And the missionary said, we don't know what to do with him. He knows the gospel. He can tell you the gospel as well as we can. But he just will not believe. And they said, would you talk to him? Like, you know, you're a missions guy. Somehow you have power. But, you know, I love those kind of conversations. So I said, I'd love to talk to him. So I did. If I remember, his name was Mustafa. And we talked. He was in the marketplace. He was a shoemaker. And so we made an appointment where he would have this conversation away from other ears. And so we got in the car and we went up on a hillside, I remember, and we talked. We talked through the gospel. We talked through who the God of the Bible is, who Jesus really is. And he was with me the whole way. And I said, so Mustafa, why will you not believe? He said, if I believe, I have to be baptized. I said, right. He said, if I'm baptized, my father will kill me. This guy was 40 years old. Wasn't a kid. If I'm baptized, my father will kill me. If my father doesn't kill me, my uncles will kill me. I will no longer be accepted in the marketplace. My whole life, my whole everything, my wife may leave me. I may lose my children. I have to come to the point of deciding if Jesus is really that important to me. And my response was, you're right, you do. You must. Everything depends on this. But in places like that, baptism is not just a rite of passage. It's not just a simple act. It's everything. It's I am identifying with Jesus. I am part of his people. And then, of course, there's teaching. There's ongoing teaching. And that ongoing teaching is not just for what we know. It's for what we do. I appreciate the emphasis even this morning on what we do. I mean, I'm in an educational environment. And I think one of the great tragedies of American or maybe Western Christianity is that our sense of discipleship, our sense of the authenticity of our relationship with God is so often based on what we know. I heard a seminary professor one time say, you can't be a true disciple of Jesus unless you're willing to get a seminary degree. It really is good I didn't have a baseball bat. I mean, I was so upset. I told him, I said, how dare you? How dare you? Don't take away the joy of those Bangladeshi believers that can't read or write, but they know Jesus. Don't take away the joy of those people in a place like Cambodia who have turned from the darkness and the hopelessness of Buddhism and have come to Jesus, but they don't know theology. They've never studied ancient languages. But they know Jesus. And I've seen this over and over again in my many years of traveling around the world and being engaged in missions. I've met people, and I've taught a lot of people in a lot of places. And I've often said to them, I've come here to teach you something from the Bible, something in which I have some area of knowledge. But what I really want is for you to teach me what it looks like to follow Jesus. Because they're doing it, and they're paying a price for it, and they're making disciples. Some of the places where the gospel is spreading the fastest and most successfully right now are the places you wouldn't expect. Probably the number one fastest growing evangelical church in the world right now is in Iran. Can you imagine that? You know why? Because Islam doesn't work. And younger people especially know it doesn't work. And the government doesn't work. And now you have people who are boldly and credibly standing up and saying, I worship Jesus. And this is what it looks like to worship Jesus. You should worship him too. And people are turning in droves to worship Jesus. Oh, they probably don't worship like we do. Probably didn't sound like we do. They probably don't look exactly like we do. They don't do things, but they know Jesus. And they're telling their friends, come worship Jesus. So here's the bottom line, folks. What is the Great Commission? The Great Commission is worship Jesus. And enjoy it so much that you want others to worship him too. That it pains me that my neighbor or my friend or my relative or my coworker does not enjoy Jesus this much. That's the Great Commission. And so as we wrap this up today, the main point is not where will you go, because once you settle this issue of I'm completely and joyfully surrendered to Jesus, to whatever he wants, to be whatever he wants, to do whatever he wants, my worship of him is complete. It's absolute surrender. And I'm practicing this week by week, day by day, and Jesus puts it in my heart to join with some others maybe who are doing something difficult in some other part of the world. And we realize that's really a great privilege to go and to do that among people who otherwise might not ever hear. And so the main question is not where will you go or what exactly will you do or how will you do it. The main question is, what is worship of Jesus driving you towards? And is it moving in your heart? Is it so satisfying for you day by day? I'm not talking only about in church, but I'm talking about in your daily life. Is your worship of Jesus such that it motivates you to share the gospel? And it opens avenues for you to do that even beyond where you are right now. In your bulletin, you have right on the cover of the bulletin, quote from John Piper. I love this quote. I think Piper gets this exactly right. You can look at that there with me. He says, worship is the fuel and goal of missions. Missions exist because worship does not. Passion for God and worship precedes the offer of God and preaching. You can't commend what you don't cherish. Missionaries will never call out, let the nations be glad, who cannot say from the heart, I rejoice in the Lord. I will be glad and exult in thee. I will sing praise to thy name, O Most High. Missions begins and ends in worship. Amen.